Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast. My name is Willie Simpson.
My name is Sonia Rappaport.
And today, Sonia, we are officially entering season 4 of the X-Men animated series. And with us to commemorate this special occasion, we have a special guest from halfway around the world.
Awesome.
Allow me to introduce Brendan Jones from the Flight Through Entirety podcast.
Hey, Brendan.
Hey, Willie. Hey, correct. You did. Thank you. Hey, Willie. Hey, Sonia. And hello, dear listeners. Thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, no. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
I would describe Brendan as more than a super fan. He is one of our earliest proponents out there in the greater podcast universe. Through one of our other Australian super fans, Nicole, she let us know that you had name-dropped us in one of your podcasts, and you have a Doctor Who podcast, correct?
That's right, that's right. So, yeah, Flight Through Entirety is a Doctor Who podcast where we are making our way through the whole history of Doctor Who. So we've covered all the old series.
Oh, my God.
Over the course of 132 episodes.
Wow.
And we're taking a bit of a break at the moment before we start covering the new show. But actually, I was always wondering how it is you found out about that shout-out so quickly, because I think it was 3 days after the episode was released, because every few episodes we kind of tell our listeners what we've been listening to or what we've been reading, and at that point I think you guys were almost at the end of series one, and just for 3 weeks at the gym I was just slamming through your podcasts. So thank you very much, Nicole, for letting Willie and Sonia know that I had told everyone who listened to my podcast to go listen to theirs.
Yeah, we were smiling ear to ear when we heard it. It was so nice, and because we had just started ourselves more or less around the time, and it just made it feel, you know, I don't know, we're a little ramshackle production here, so it gave a sprinkle of legitimacy to what we were doing at the time. So now we're a big shot superstar. So
that's right. Yeah, all the best podcasts are little ramshackle productions.
Right.
Pretty much.
I want to talk about Doctor Who real quick. So you're doing the entire, yeah. So what does that entail, doing the entire series?
So yeah, we've just been doing it in broadcast order, and there are kind of five of us who rotate on the podcast. So there's myself, there's Richard and Nathan, Todd, and occasionally James as well. He hasn't been in it so much because we didn't want to like overload the podcast with five people, but he's going to be doing more of the new series. And yeah, it's just all of us have grown up with Doctor Who since like the age of five. So we were discussing both our experiences back when we were kids and coming back to it now, which is kind of what you and Sonia do with X-Men. You know, you talk about how it made you feel when you were kids and what you think of it now as well.
I want to ask, yeah. So it's 132 episodes of the original series?
There's about 160 stories in the original series. We've got slightly fewer episodes because when we started out, we were doing two or three stories per episode.
Okay, yeah.
And then after 30 episodes, we started just doing one story per episode and going a bit deeper into it.
Right.
Yeah, so that's why we have slightly, about 30 fewer episodes than there are actual stories in the old series. And I think in terms of stories now, they're up to about 275 across 800 and something episodes.
Oh my God.
Wow.
That's both series put together. So
well,
it's formidable.
Right. In the grand scope of things, like how like deep are you going to get?
Generally, we're sticking to stuff that is just on television rather than looking at the novels or the audio dramas or anything like that. Okay. Occasionally, we have sort of delved into some of that spin-off media. Especially, there was one doctor in the 1980s who was fired after two seasons because of politics. It wasn't really anything wrong with his performance. And so he's come back and done all these audio dramas and just really played the character how he wanted to at the time. So we discussed him, because if you just take his TV stuff, it's not that great, but the stuff he's done later is much, much better. But generally, yeah, we've just stuck to the TV series, and that's still taken us 3.5 years to get through.
Oh my God.
I believe
the classic series. Yeah. Yeah.
I have like a lot of respect for Doctor Who fans personally, because I didn't grow up with Doctor Who, I grew up more with like Star Wars, Star Trek type of nerd media. And then like at some point in like college or like early adulthood, Doctor Who kind of like came into my like sphere of consciousness for the first time. And it was like before it was on any streaming services and I didn't really know how to get a hold of it. But like people would just be mentioning, you know, like you'd hear little like name drops or whatever of Doctor Who or like, oh, wow, you know, and it was really like that's the holy grail of like nerd culture, like coming from a place where, you know, I didn't have easy access to it. I was like, ooh, what's that? Like,
wait, so Doctor Who's the holy grail?
Of this like
of televised nerd culture.
I think so. Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah. And not Star Trek.
Well, it's like a matter of access. You know what I mean? See. Like,
yeah. Right? Yeah, because there's something a little for as Americans is a little more exotic with like because it's British.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah,
it's
no,
that I've like had interest to get into, but then like when you're confronted with the fact that it's like 800 episodes worth or whatever, it's also a little intimidating thing, so that like adds another level of prestige to it. You know.
I like, mean, you know, Brendan, you've got me interested in Doctor Who. I've never really seen it. I only know about parodies of it through shows like Community.
Oh yeah, of course.
The parody on that show it's escaping me right now. But whatever. The point is, like, just randomly, you know, in our early 30s here, we've just decided to become Star Trek fans. We've mentioned it on the podcast a few times.
Yeah.
And we've just been binge watching the hell out of it. My excuse is it's coping with the Trump presidency. It's like my escape from reality. Like, so I mean, it's just we've gone through 7 seasons of Next Generation, 7 seasons of Voyager, and we're now 2 seasons through Deep Space Nine, 2.5 seasons through Enter. I mean, we're just watching it every day, hour after hour. It's like it is destroying our brains, but
it is. But also, it's like it's winter here. It's cold and rainy and snowy, and you don't want to go outside. And like we've had our fair share of like, you know, catching cold and cough and whatever. It's like escape from winter, escape from presidency and politics.
Yes.
And just
yeah.
So I feel like this is the winter of Star Trek, and who knows, maybe next winter will be the winter of Doctor Who.
Yeah,
we'll
I'm
see.
Certainly intrigued. We're gonna see how much gluttons for punishment we are in the sense of like those holy grails of science fiction stuff.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, so your podcast again, Flight Through Entirety.
That's right, yes.
Why is it so hard to say?
Okay.
And I don't mean to criticize your show by saying...
No, absolutely. Like, I design most of the logos we use, so I take the Doctor Who logo and put our words into it, and the amount of times I've misspelled it and used the wrong word, because where it comes from is a very early episode of Doctor Who was called Flight Through Eternity.
Ooh.
See, that's what my brain keeps wanting.
That's what you want to say, yeah. Exactly, because that makes sense. Whereas our title doesn't.
Well, I like your title because it's clever. Yeah, it's
exactly.
A good joke.
It's a twist on it. Yeah.
And well, from that we spun off, and we also have a James Bond podcast called Bondfinger.
Ooh, that's exciting. I gotta get into that. See, the Doctor Who one would be daunting for me because I've never watched it.
Yeah.
But James Bond, did you start the classic Sean Connery? I'm guessing.
Yeah. Well, again, those ones were going in order, but we're doing them as commentaries. we have dinner, we crack open a few bottles of wine, and then we start recording. So
I want to hear that.
You can imagine
what's that one called for everyone out there.
So that's Bondfinger.
Oh, great name.
Yep.
So and that was we have a James on there. He came up with that. So when we introduce ourselves, it's hello, I'm Brendan. I'm Nathan. I'm Richard. And I'm James. And we all say, oh, James. So you can, your listeners can find our podcast at flightthroughentirety.com or bondfinger.com. So that's where we are.
I instruct everyone with a passing interest in either of those things to go there right now and subscribe, download, and become fans. That is my order to X-Men Task Nation, which is now a thing I have dubbed.
So aggressive.
to me, my X-Men Task listeners.
Well, Brendan, it's absolutely wonderful to have you on the show. I asked you a long time ago to come on, and you're like, I want to do One Man's Worth, and that was like a million weeks ago.
yeah, because and I don't think I told you this, when you asked me to come on, I was partway through writing back, oh, I'd love to do a Rogue's Tale, and then I just thought, I'll go to the Facebook page and check, and you'd literally released it that week, and I thought, oh darn, okay. And then I looked at like the episodes upcoming, and the reason I picked One Man's Worth is the time travel element, and there's actually a Doctor Who story that covers similar things, which I might mention as we go through the podcast.
Please feel free.
Yeah, very cool.
So this episode, if I hadn't mentioned, 48th overall, first episode of season 4, although that is sort of weirdly debatable. It's definitely listed on the internet as the correct like season 4 premiere. But in my, like, see, now that it's been taken off Hulu, I don't know internationally how you're watching X-Men TAS, and that's sort of weird of me to say internationally. From where you're from, we're international. in my, like, old download folder of X-Men episodes, the way it's ordered, it's, like, the fourth and fifth episode. So I think we've now officially lost track of, like, where these episodes are supposed to go.
Yeah.
And in
everyone
what order.
Everyone just hang on for the ride from here on out.
yeah. And there's those weird episodes that were meant to be in season 3 that got broadcast in season 5. Yeah. All that nonsense.
Right. I remember as a kid, when season 5 arrived, being completely confused. I had, like, the vaguest inkling that something was amiss, but I couldn't quite put two and two together. But, Brendan, tell me about your experience with the X-Men animated show. I'm guessing you were a big fan, and otherwise you wouldn't be slamming our podcast at the gym.
Well, when I was a kid, it was on weekday mornings, so I think Monday to Thursday, and then I think Friday was I don't know, Captain Simian and the Space Monkeys or Ninja Turtles or something. My brother was actually big into it because he's 9 years older than me and he read the comics.
Mm.
So when the animated show came on, he was big into it. So I would watch it before school as well. One Man's Worth was kind of weird, though, because Australian TV in, I guess, 92, 93, 94, whenever this episode went out.
Probably like 95.
95, I'm seeing your end, so it might have been 96 for us.
Yeah.
Anyway, at that point, they did this weird thing of they were putting kids' shows on Sunday night at 6 p.m., which is a prime time slot in Australia. And so the first half of X-Men Series 4 was going out at, like, Sunday dinner time, which just blew my mind. You know, cartoons on in the evening. This is usually when we're watching sitcoms or dramas or something.
Right.
So One Man's Worth was put out as, like, a one-hour special.
Wow.
In Australia. So it is... There are sort of a few episodes of X-Men which are just burned into my brain. So there's that one, there's Rogue's Tale, and Come the Apocalypse from season 1.
Yeah.
That's just the bit under Stonehenge.
Yes.
Yep.
Destruction of the Eiffel Tower.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I think it was maybe about 5 or 6 weeks, and then it went back to being on in the mornings. And it wasn't until my fiance and I, Rod, were watching X-Men. We watched it, like, I found it on a streaming service in Australia. And just went, okay, we're watching this now. And he said, oh, yes, yes.
I forced Sonya to watch the X-Men cartoon with me like 4 or 5 years ago. And I gave her the entire podcast then as she was like trying to read a book or something. this is like a repeat, but recorded for posterity's sake.
Oh, that's brilliant. But, I mean, that's the wonderful thing about this show in that you can come back to it as an adult. I've tried to come back to other cartoon series I used to watch.
Yeah,
but there's still something in X-Men for adults. And after about the 6th episode, Rod actually turned to me and said, there's some real, like, depth in this, and they're making social commentary, and this is about racism. I'm like, that's what it is.
And this episode is like a real, like, heavy hitter when it comes to, like, all the best elements of the X-Men cartoon. It's funny you said this is one that was burned into your mind. This is one I've only seen maybe like 2 times in my life, weirdly.
Right.
I don't know why. I think, like, whenever I would do my rerun, like, I'd occasionally rewatch it, you know, every 5 years or so, the entire series out of boredom. and this is one I would either kind of skip over or just not pay attention to or something. But sitting rewatching it today, it was like really great. It's just everything I love about the cartoon, and very well done. It wasn't sloppy. Like, a few of the episodes towards the end of season three felt a little sloppier to me. But this one is, like, prime quality.
Yeah. It's like they've had a bit of a rest and thought, how can we push this in a new direction? Because we've just had the Phoenix sagas, which were massive.
Yes.
So,
that was, like, a huge peak.
Yes, yeah. And it's like they've gone, what are the other really big plot lines from the comics we can use?
Right, yeah.
So we got Age... So this is like essentially like a takeoff of Age of Apocalypse, right?
Yeah, condensed into two episodes.
Yeah, and without Apocalypse.
And without Apocalypse.
I mean, and it's funny, it's like... Maybe this is the reason why it kind of glazed over me as a kid and even later in adulthood, was because that I think Age of Apocalypse was right around the time I stopped reading the X-Men comics around that age. It got too like confusing for me as a kid. You know, it's right. Like, I don't know. So I maybe it didn't connect with me in that way. But everyone loves Age of Apocalypse. It's like definitely a classic X-Men storyline. And people really point to this episode as like a great, you know, like... I wouldn't say faithful recreation of it, but like a nice like tribute to it in a weird way.
Yeah. I think it's clever that they haven't tried to like check in with absolutely everyone, because the Age of Apocalypse was just massive. They've just kind of gone, we're going to focus on this one story which could take place in this universe. But they give you like little snippets and tasters. Like we see Mimic and we see...
And Magneto and is the general or something.
With a lot of cameos from various X-Men places.
Exactly. Yeah. The weird thing I found watching those cameos, though, because I was like, oh, yeah, that's such and such. Blah, blah, blah. It's like everyone's got a new outfit or a different hairstyle or a beard.
Yeah.
And... Gambit looks exactly the same.
Yeah. No, he had like a patch on his trench coat.
And
he was missing an arm.
Terrible,
right?
Sorry.
No, but you're right. He had the same bright pink like body armor and yoga pants that he enjoys to wear.
Where is that camouflage? He's got this dark brown trench coat to blend in.
We were children in the early 90s, but the dance club scene back then, there was a lot of like pink laser lights and like electric blue flashing. Gambit would have like snuck in easily.
That's true, actually. That is a really good point. I mean, just look at the Super Mario Brothers movie, or better yet, don't.
I saw that movie in the theater with my best friend. I don't know how old I was, 9, 10. I was entertained.
I had no idea. I really loved it when I was a kid. I went to see it with my sister, and like we thought it was so great.
I didn't understand why like more of the video game wasn't in it. That's what annoyed me the most about it, that there just wasn't like the music or like whatever. But at the same time, I don't know. But you're right. It's a terrible movie.
Yeah, it's one of the, one of the ones that doesn't hold up.
Well, it maybe does. It's like a good bad movie to like watch.
Yeah.
It was entertaining. But like you, I was sitting there going, but the Goombas don't look like that.
Yeah, it was scary.
Yeah, and Yoshi doesn't look like that. And what have they done to Toad? But I still enjoyed it.
I don't know why I enjoy. I think I just enjoyed John Leguizamo as Luigi or something. And I thought the guy who played Mario, a famous actor.
Bob Hoskins.
Yeah, Bob Hoskins, who was going to play Wolverine in the 80s, believe it or not, X fans. I thought he was too old to be Mario. That disappointed me as a kid. But I don't know. Actually, and this is a stupid tangent, but Nintendo released some stupid information about Mario recently, saying that he's 25 years old, and that, too, is blasphemy. So
really? I don't think so.
I don't know how that was an original complaint I had. All right, anyway, back to the X-Men.
Yes.
This episode opens in 1959, May 11th, to be exact, at Bard College. And that's like, where is that, Sonia?
That's Upper Manhattan.
Upper Manhattan, right. Yeah. It doesn't look like it. It looks quite suburban. So,
no, it's in Manhattan.
I know, but the way it's presented in the cartoon doesn't...
It's like on the Upper West Side. I mean,
I've never been there.
It's a nice campus.
Okay, but it doesn't look like that, does it?
it's a cartoon. I don't know.
I know, but
tall buildings and trees.
It's just the way you
it's
were talking
college.
When we were watching the show. Sonya was talking about, oh, I know Bard College. It's a women's school.
Well, I had friends that went there. It turns out it's not a women's school. I'm not quite sure why I thought that, because then I had to look it up on the internet to make sure. And yeah, a lot of like really famous creative people have come out of there, men and women. But I guess it was one of like the earlier colleges to open its doors to women as well. It was like one of the earlier co-ed colleges. Maybe that's where I got the idea from.
Well, see, you know all about this Bard College. That's
well,
why I thought
I
you knew
Thanks
what
Wikipedia.
It looked like.
Okay. All right.
I guess anyone can know about Bard College. They don't have to have had friends that went there. But anyway, it opens up in Bard College. It's where young Professor X goes to school. And then we're like crazily whiplashed around different timelines really fast. You could get lost very quickly watching the opening of this episode. We're introduced to like Bishop, Wolverine, and Storm. They're fighting Nimrod in the like altered present day. They were fighting him in the past. Sorry, I'm going to be a little bit confused recapping. Brendan, feel free to recap this more properly if I'm screwing this up. And then we like cut to 2055, which they remind us is the future, just in case. Just in case maybe this you're watching this after 2055.
No, it's because it's kids watching. If you ask a 7-year-old like what year it is, they probably, I mean, maybe some of them could tell you. But
everyone knows what year it is. No, you don't have
they
to
don't.
Be. What are you talking about?
It's like as a kid, you're like, I think it's got a 9 in it, maybe?
Exactly.
No,
yeah.
You guys are crazy. I was very aware of the years as a child.
Well, we used
actually,
to write
be...
it, like, at the top of our page at school every
yeah.
day. You'd have to write, like,
yeah,
the name and the date. But now, well,
and
I don't
you're
know.
And you taught your birthday. Like, you have a sense of what time is. Isn't
it? I don't know. I teach at an elementary school now, and the kids don't have to do that. And the other day, I asked a whole class of, like, 8-year-olds what country they live in. And, like, most of them didn't know. Like,
really?
Most of them couldn't tell me USA.
That might not be such a bad thing at
I
this
mean,
time
I got
history.
A few, like, New York cities, and I was like, it's not really a country. We do live in New York. Anyway, moving on.
And you're the art teacher. Oh,
anyway.
Boy. Honestly, I think it says the future because 2055, I think at the time, might have looked a little weird to any audience member just to see 2055 like imprinted on the screen. Like, you're supposed to know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
That's still a pretty crazy year.
Yes.
I just think that 2055 is in 1995, that's a really awkward year to present to an audience. This is just my crackpot theory.
It's
so,
like not too far in the future, really.
But it just still looks strange because it was still the 1990s, and it's just there's something about transitioning to the 21st century. I don't know, especially for a kids' audience. They just had to let you know it was the future.
Mm-hmm.
All right, small point. It's 2055. We see characters Bishop, Shard, whose name is actually not even said in this episode, I noticed. Shard.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Shard is Bishop's sister. Spoilers for the second part of this episode. We also see Forge and it's like we're being really whiplashed around time. And then we go to the present day, the 90s, where we see Wolverine, Storm, and Professor X enjoying a sunny day in their X-Mansion gardens.
Well, Professor X isn't there right away. Storm, like, comes up the hill. She walks up the hill where Wolverine is, like, hanging out in a tree eating an apple.
In his lime green tank top.
Just strangely to find him. He's, like, communing with nature, like, sitting on the branches of this tree. Anyways.
And then, someone's making a joke about Adam and Eve and how, oh, don't bite the apple. It's bad.
Yeah.
And Professor X says something along the lines of, I never liked in that story that the message is that knowledge ruins paradise.
Mm.
And my question to you guys is, does knowledge ruin paradise?
Wow.
Brendan.
So,
Brendan, I'm sorry.
Look, it's quite all right.
Someone ring a bell every time I mispronounce Brendan's name.
It's almost a political point, really, isn't it? The idea that the less you know, the happier you are, because the more you know, the more you can be discontented with. So, you know, if you don't know nasty things our politicians are doing, they can't bother you. So I don't think knowledge so much ruins paradise. It's maybe that knowledge shows you that paradise isn't all it's cracked up to be. Necessarily.
Well, you know, I saw some 60 Minutes or news, like journalism, something on this like 100-year-old man who lives in a remote South African mountain, South American mountain somewhere, and he lives all by himself. His family died like 30 years ago. He, you know, has his own goats or something that where he gets all his milk and food from, and he does all his own wood chopping, and you know, periodically they send like a local policeman to check on him every 3 months to make sure he's still alive and kicking, and he has no television, no radio. They said in the little documentary that he gets the newspaper like once every like 1 or 2 years just to sort of see what's going on, but you know he has no concept of current events or anything, and he's not unintelligent, he's not ignorant or anything. He just lives a solitary life. And when they're telling him in the thing, they're telling him, it's like, oh, did you know 9/11 happened? And he's like, no. and then it makes you wonder, like, what is the real value of knowing what's going on in the world that doesn't necessarily directly affect you in any way? So, I mean, not saying I advocate this type of viewpoint or lifestyle, but it makes you wonder, like, you perfectly could just exist in the world and shut yourself off and just carry on and not, you know, and maybe your life is markedly better. I mean, he seemed to be doing okay. I mean, he's in total isolation, but outside of that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's the old saying, ignorance is bliss. I don't know.
Or hell is other people.
How much truth there is to that, but, you know, he just has to hope that, like, I don't know, maybe this is a cynical way to look at it, but, like, hope that, like, none of that catastrophic type of violence like comes to his mountain, you know what I mean?
Well,
like,
well, if it did come to his mountain, it would come in a blinding red flash of the timeline reasserting itself violently.
Yes.
So that's what happens in the present day. Professor X, he's wiped out in a red fury, and now we zoom in on Storm and Wolverine. They're sort of in different crazy outfits in a hellscape on the X-Mansion grounds. Brendan, you were talking earlier about like cameos and other things going on. What struck out to you about this moment?
Just before going into this moment, I've always really loved the line of why can't we just attract ants like normal people?
Solid Wolverine impression, by the way.
You know, it's as you guys constantly pick up on, you know, you take away Wolverine's ability to kill, you have to give him all these witty one-liners instead. But yeah, what I remember as a kid, what kind of struck me was, you know, that mild flirtation between Logan and Aurora in that first scene, and then that gives away, and yeah, you know, they're holding each other, and they keep kind of in this alternative Storm's got a mohawk timeline,
and then wedding rings, which you could see
exactly, and I remember as a kid going, oh wow. And I even remember thinking, so does that mean Wolverine is over Jean? Has that gone by the wayside now? And he's going to build up this thing with Storm? And I, as a kid, I'm just like, that's so cool.
But tell me, did you notice, was Jean Grey alive? Because it looked like she was a nurse, maybe, in the mutant, you know, war mesh tent there.
She's got that little cameo, so I think she's fine. But yeah, for whatever reason, in this world, Logan has fallen for Aurora instead of Jean. And Storm, I think Storm, Gambit, and Rogue were my favorites as a kid. So to any story that pushed any of three of them up, I was really there for. So Storm being my brother, and my brother was not happy that Gambit was my favorite because Wolverine was his favorite, and Gambit was just a dirty thief, you know. and he still says, I can't believe Gambit's your favorite.
Classic brother rivalry.
He wanted some Wolverine solidarity.
I will say, though, and a part of the appeal for me for X-Men, I realized in later years, is, of course, growing up gay, and you don't, when you don't realize when you're a kid, but you know that there's something different. Rewatching the show, the early show, and Gambit is just kind of there to say, like, there's always more alligators in the bayou, I remember, was one of your guys' favorite ones. And I'm just sitting there during the first few episodes going, why was Gambit my favorite? He's just a bit, you know, wet. He says a few lines here. And then, of course, there's that infamous scene where he's walking down the corridor in a Speedo. I'm like, ah! even as a kid. But I digress.
Also, that's a good digression, because the sexiness of this show was kind of off the charts, especially for children. I always thought it was a bit risque watching it as a kid.
Well, in terms of Jean, you know that those sort of flesh tone patches of her uniform?
Yeah.
I didn't realize they were nude there.
I thought
she just had her uniform glued onto her or something.
Yeah.
And I remember as a kid going, "Oh, that's a bit rude."
Yeah. Well, we had the same discussion about Sabretooth in the last episode, because he takes off his brown glove, and then it makes you wonder what, like, because his hand is the same color as the rest of his tan uniform, right? So it's like, is he just wearing a brown unitard, like, going over his crotch? Like, what is? So, I mean,
I'm like,
you
could
have the same question about Gina. You know, it's very reasonable to make that jump.
Does that mean Sabretooth invented the mankini?
Well, maybe not invented, but certainly popularized.
Yeah.
Well, but it's more like a wintry mankini, though. Because it's got a fur collar.
Well, but is that a collar or is that his fur?
Oh, right.
The lines are really blurred with Sabretooth.
Yeah, I know. His costume is baffling. Someone needs to do a scientific study on it.
The fur mankini. God, that's disgusting.
Yeah, but I mean, this was a very sexy show, I thought. You know,
I'm sure it
stirred a lot of awakenings in children, whatever, you know, their sexual orientation might have been or might be to this day. You know what I mean? Like, I just remember just staring at Rogue as a little boy and just being very happy about it. And we always talk about the two. They're just like, it's kind of shocking that Wolverine, who is completely has no chance with Jean, he's totally in the friend zone, more or less, for lack of a better phrase, that he doesn't think about Storm in the normal continuity. Storm is this gorgeous, you know, like, supermodel that portrayed by Halle Berry, like, and dare I say, like, Halle Berry not as beautiful as the comic book cartoon version of Storm, and Halle Berry is among the most beautiful people on the planet. You know what I'm saying?
But they have to, like, give that to Wolverine, because that's, like, a key part of his characterization, is this, like, this yearning, unfulfilled love story that's part of his tragic appeal for, like, a lot of the fans of Wolverine.
Fine, but I'm calling total bullshit, because if Wolverine, you know, he's surrounded by these supermodel-y women, he would be, I think he would easily, like, give up on Jean and say, wow, Aurora. and in this timeline, he has the common sense to do so.
Well, the thing is, maybe Wolverine has a bit more depth than we give him credit for, and maybe it's not just physical, you know.
I'm sure it's not.
There's two things about the X films, just in general, that sort of niggle me a bit, and I don't particularly like. And generally, these are very low down, but I think the balance of the love triangle between Scott, Jean, and Logan in the films, I think Jean is a little too interested in Logan for my liking in the films.
Yeah, agreed.
Like, yeah. She betrays Scott too easily in a way.
Yeah, whereas in the cartoon, she is clearly fond of Logan and has some feelings for him, but kind of goes, no, I'm with Scott and I'm gonna be loyal. The other thing is, and I think this might be a bit controversial, I'm not a big fan of Halle Berry as Storm.
Oh, no, that's not controversial at all.
Oh, okay, good. I think she's a fantastic actress.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I love Halle Berry. As Storm, it was not working.
Yeah. There was actually another actress who was up for the role called Margene Holden. who is 6 foot tall. Sci-fi fans can see her in the Babylon 5 spin-off Crusade as the ship's doctor. But yeah, she's 6 foot tall. She's a martial arts expert. She has been in the Mortal Kombat films doing her own stunts. So they have
Googling as we speak.
Oh, yeah. So they had the choice between this 6 foot tall martial arts expert to play Storm and Halle Berry, and they went with Halle Berry because Halle's a good actress and also the star name.
Right.
Because Hugh Jackman wasn't a big star back then.
And yeah, but I wonder, I feel like Halle Berry's stardom might not have even fully taken off until right after X-Men 2.
Yeah, she was up and coming then.
Yeah, it carries on that tradition where their casting is like so amazing with the timing, because they cast Halle Berry, she's not quite the star she would become just a few short years later, and then the same thing happened with Jennifer Lawrence with Mystique, and then they kind of get backed into those roles in a way where it didn't really happen with Halle Berry. They didn't really feature her as prominently as they should have in a sense, or the character of Storm, but it certainly happened with Jennifer Lawrence that they had to make her the star of the series going forward.
Yeah. And you know what?
Kind of a weird coincidence.
I think it's great that, and this is going to sound really bitchy, I think it's great that Halle Berry's career has survived Storm
and Catwoman. Yeah.
And Die Another Day.
Right.
the Bond film.
Oh, which she was awful, she's not
terrible. Yeah, well, the whole film's terrible. You know, it's hard to just pin down one person. But when you computer generated Pierce Brosnan windsurfing a tsunami, you know you've got problems.
Yeah. It's good that I think it's. I actually really like the pairing of Wolverine and Storm. I think that's a nice pairing.
So good.
Right, yeah. And it's so they're, in this alternate future, the timeline's been altered. There's spoilers, it's because Professor Xavier was killed in the past. So because Professor Xavier doesn't live, the world we know is a dystopia where the sky is like almost like on fire red.
That's how you tell it's dystopia.
Right, yeah. The sky is just like a deep crimson red of blood and fire. Mm-hmm. And it's a generic war between the mutants and the humans. It's almost everything Magneto wanted. And you can see Magneto is the leader of this movement of the mutant side. And it's like a weird wish fulfillment for Magneto's character because he's getting the war he wanted, but it's not going as well as I think he thought it would. So, because it looks like the mutants are really being like backed into a corner here. It's actually hard to tell who's winning this war. It looks like the Earth is just ruined either way.
Yeah.
And so in this war, we see lots of weird cameos. We see, like, it looks like a green Iron Man flying around. I mean, we've seen a lot of, like, weird War Machine and Iron Man cameos in this series, but sometimes it's hard to tell if they're just generic robots or they're Iron Men as we know them. We see that. We see, like, Beast is around. He's got, like, a whole bunch of cybernetic things on his body. Wolverine refers to him as McCoy. What else? Oh, we see Magneto. He's got like a grungy beard, and his powers are really being pushed to the limit. He's referred to as the General, and he's trying his best. Brendan, as you mentioned, Mimic, sort of like a weird, like super throwback callback.
Yeah, such a weird character to include.
Mimic's from like the original, like super original 60s run, right?
That's right, yeah. So he comes in around, I want to say, sometime in issue 20 and 40, I feel like. It's that early on.
Yeah, but it like might have been post-Stan Lee Kirby, like whoever took it over right after them, but before the series was canceled. I don't remember much of the Mimic storylines, but he could take on other mutant powers, I'm guessing, whoever he was surrounded by.
Yeah. So he kind of nicks everyone's powers, then leaves. He's like the Poochie of the X-Men.
Right. That's right. That's a good description. That made me laugh. We see. I didn't think we'd see Nightcrawler again, but he's back.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. He's a little more swashbuckling. He's got his outfits a little more like future techie in a weird way. Different hairstyle. He doesn't say anything, but he's, jumping around. We see Mr. Sinister blasting away in the distance. I guess he's an ally of Magneto. And we see one-armed Gambit, which is kind of sad. Beast refers to him as his friend. And then we kind of see, like, the evil Avengers marching around.
The superhumans.
Right.
Which kind of raised a question for me. It's like, one... we're being told, oh, the humans are attacking, but they send in robots, so we don't see any humans. Right. And then all of a sudden, the humans are using superhumans, so presumably mutants they created. So it's like, hold on, what's your problem with the mutants if you're going to be creating mutants?
I mean, that's going to be something that really, once Disney, if, you know, assuming Disney merges with Fox here, they're really going to have to explain why mutants are so persecuted, whereas, like, other heroes are relatively celebrated. It's because it's a distinction that never really made sense in the Marvel Universe, like why Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four are... I mean, I know Spider-Man had his own problems with the media and what have you, but still there's like a distinction made between the regular superheroes and the mutants who are kind of oppressed and bigoted against.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So they're going to have to like discuss why they're...
I mean, they don't have to discuss right, anything. Yeah. I think this could go on like... potentially forever without a real explanation.
I guess you're right. But to me, it doesn't make sense why, like, Reed Richards is a respected member of society, but, you know, Professor X might be, you know, someone might throw a tomato at him.
I mean, I think that's in keeping with, like, the real-life situations that run parallel to this, like, storyline. You know what I mean? It's, like, traditionally persecuted groups of people, like... will also have like a special standing in society in some ways, whether it's in like the entertainment industry or like some specific like section of society where they're really like put on a pedestal, but then as like a group of people they're stereotyped and like
so you're saying like Reed Richards, he's like he would be the exception to people's general mistrust and hatred of superpowered people,
maybe.
I could buy that.
It's kind of the thing of years ago when I was living in the UK, I was around at a friend's place and his housemate was going off on sort of a low-key rant about, you know, oh, you know, immigrants are only coming over here to use the NHS. And I said, oh, thanks, mate. Yeah. And he literally said to me, no, not you, you're white.
Right, yeah.
And I just went, whoa! And he's like, no, I didn't mean it like that. I said, I think you did. But it's the whole thing of they'll go off about mutants. Oh, but, you know, not Reed Richards. He saved that building from being blown up. Just the other mutants.
Right, yeah.
Like you say, Sonia, a special standing for a certain group, so long as they stay in their place.
He has better publicity or something.
Yes.
And then just harping on the cameos, this is a great like cameo episode. We see Mastermind, who we last saw in the Dark Phoenix saga. He's using his powers to effective means to fool a robot, which kind of doesn't make sense. we saw Nurse Jean Grey, and we hear a mention of a Dr. Summers over a loudspeaker. So the future is chock full of cameos, but then the plot sort of shifts again to Bishop and his sister Shard, and they're gonna be using time travel again to fix the continuity of things. The thing that's like never like explained on the show, but is pretty consistent, is that Bishop's always trying to save his timeline, but his timeline is consistently shitty, which it doesn't jive with the sense that like. I mean, the writers keep seeming to be telling the audience that the X-Men do fail, or that a greater, like a worse fate is going to befall humanity after the X-Men's time. And that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting that all of Bishop's futures that he comes from, because his future keeps changing.
He keeps fixing it or trying to.
Mm. Yeah, none of them are a utopia. He's just trying to make a slightly less terrible future.
Yeah.
And it just makes me think, when he finally gets what he wants, is he going to be addicted to time travel? Is it going to be like, oh, I really don't like the colors of my curtains. Beep, beep, beep. Go back 2 years. And no, Bishop, don't choose the orange curtains. And then he gets back.
Yeah.
Oh, he's addicted. Blue.
That's like a great idea for a science fiction movie or TV show premise. You're just addicted to time travel. That's like a really, I would watch that.
Yeah, I may have to write that.
Yeah, copyright that before someone steals it.
Yes, that's all right. No one's just heard me say that. It's fine.
So Bishop, you know, he realizes what's going on, that Professor X was murdered. So he first travels to this dystopian past. I guess he was trying to... he got there too late, which didn't quite make sense. In the X-Men universe, time, when time gets changed, it like comes like a ocean wave. We saw that in a previous Bishop Cable episode where like tornadoes were randomly changing the future in Cable's time, and Cable still had time to go back and fix it before he was erased from the timeline. So I guess it's like the same principle at play here, and we're going to get into a lot of bizarre time travel stuff in season four, by the way, Sonya, just giving you a heads up.
Yeah. Well, but I think I'm okay with it, though. You know, it's like that butterfly effect thing where it's like you go back to fix something, but then you get back to your timeline and you realize like, oh, I didn't fix everything. Now I like messed up something else. Got to go back again. You know, it's like if you hadn't messed with it in the first place, only one major thing would be wrong. Whereas now it's like too convoluted and you like have to keep going back and readjusting. Like it, whatever. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, Doctor Who is quite inconsistent in the way it handles this. Sometimes timelines will change immediately, and sometimes it'll be a matter of if we're fast enough, we can get there before the timeline changes. Mm. The old series of Doctor Who didn't do that much in terms of paradoxes. And the story I mentioned earlier, I think in the US it's available on a streaming service called BritBox. And it's called Day of the Daleks. And the premise of it is that in the 22nd century, the Daleks, which are sort of the main cyborg enemy in Doctor who have a whisk and a sink plunger for weapons, they have invaded the Earth. And so a bunch of human resistance fighters go back to the 20th century to try and kill the person they believe is responsible for plunging the world into a world war, which left the Earth weakened and led to that invasion. And
no pun intended, plunging.
Yeah, exactly. but yeah, I won't reveal the twist for anyone, but it is similar to this in that it's the concept of by killing or not killing this one person, the whole future can be changed. And yeah, I would recommend anyone go watch it. It is a really good story, Day of the Daleks. But as a kid, having that in my brain and having this in my brain, I have always made that connection between these two stories.
Interesting.
Maybe that's a good entry point for us as Doctor Who novices.
Yeah, maybe. I just, like, I always had a little trouble with that concept of, like, we have to do this before it's too late, when, like, what you're dealing with is time travel. So, in essence, too late kind of shouldn't be a concept, because you can, if you're going back in time anyway and you can choose when you go back to, then it's all kind of relative. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And often people are going back to, like, not leaving themselves enough time to really fix the thing.
Right. And then it's like, well, okay, well, it shouldn't really be a problem. Like, just go back again, except land yourself 10 minutes earlier or 10 hours earlier or whatever it is that you're going to need to really be prepared, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And it's the concept of also, can you go back again if you screw up, which, spoiler alert, is going to happen in the next episode.
It's the Back to the Future 2 premise.
Yeah. But then if you do go back and you succeed, there's no reason for you to have gone back, because you've only gone back again to succeed, but now you've succeeded. you're past it.
And it around you go.
Exactly. And that's. But I think the writers have been very clever in that the first time we see Bishop, he introduces, you know, this is my time bracelet or whatever he calls it. If you destroy this, it negates all my changes. And it's like, oh, well, that's how they exist outside of time, as Master Mold puts
it. I'm going to have to stop you there. I don't know if it negates his changes. I think it just sends him back to the future.
Oh, yes. Actually, you're right. Yes. Yeah, it just destabilizes him and he snaps back. Yeah.
I just want to say, like, the more, like, Star Trek we watch and X-Men, like, any science fiction where there's time travel, the more I get reassured if you actually try to look up what real physicists have to say about time travel. And I feel like there's a general consensus, at least with today's science as of 2018, that backwards time travel is completely impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of reassuring. As great as it would be to travel back in time and explore and do all these, like, fun, amazing things, it's just, like, every, like, consequence is too, like, mind-boggling mind-boggling to contemplate, and there's too many negative consequences. And the fact that, like, it seems that physicists are just saying you just can't do it physically in the real world is kind of a good sign. It's like a thumbs up to the universe.
Yeah.
It's almost as if the universe or whoever said, you know, time travel, backwards time travel is just not going to happen.
Yeah,
you
know, it's a bad idea. Yeah.
Nothing's going to make sense if it's real, if it's allowed.
It's like, yeah, you humans, you just screw it up.
Yeah. We're definitely not going to let advanced monkeys travel back in time.
You guys are creating self-driving cars that still crash. No, you can't have time travel.
All right, so let's plow through this first part. So in order to convince Storm and Wolverine to join them on their crusade to fix the timeline, they show them secret footage of Master Mold, the evil sentinel that controls all the other evil robots in the future, making some deal with some bizarre mutant called Fitzroy and his little sidekick called Bantam, who's like this real sniveling sidekick. I don't know anything about Fitzroy. Brendan, do you know anything about him?
Not really. I seem to recall I had a set of X-Men trading cards from 1994, and he was on one of them, kind of like he's a bit like Rogue. He can drain people's power and use it to create time portals. But yeah,
that's a crazy power to be born with.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know much else about him aside from that.
It lends the question, why is he making a deal with Master Mold to... So the deal he makes with Master Mold is, I'm going to go back in time and make your troubles less for you by killing Xavier. You'll have no resistance whatsoever in the future. And Master Mold's like, well, you better get video evidence because I'm not going to remember it if you change the past. Which is insane. An insane condition in this deal. Only from Fitzroy's standpoint, it's like, you can travel through time. Why don't you just go to some better time where you're not dealing with murders? Where you could just go to Hawaii and live a peaceful life and, you know, do whatever you need to do. Obviously, as a time traveler, you know about, you can get lottery numbers. It makes no Fitzroy's motivation in these episodes makes zero sense. I think that's safe to say.
Yeah, it also makes me wonder why Forge never gives Bishop a video camera. Because whenever Bishop turns up again, Forge is like, Bishop turns up and says, I stopped the assassination. Yeah, well, you didn't stop the virus, did you?
Right, yeah.
You really stopped. What virus? I didn't know anything about that. Oh, maybe you're from another timeline. Yes, I just came through a time portal.
I know. Forge's roles in all these things are always confusing because he sort of half knows about Bishop's mission sometimes, and then at times he just doesn't remember, and it's a little inconsistent there.
Yeah.
Forge.
The only thing I can think with Fitzroy is maybe there are other constraints on his powers that we don't know about. Like, he always snaps back to a certain timeline, or, like, once he's used the drained power from a mutant, then, like, something... You know what I mean? Like, maybe...
Yeah.
Maybe there's a reason that he's not, like, going back. But the other thing I've thought often is that, like... Even if time travel were physically possible, if, like, physicists tomorrow were like, guess what? We've just invented it, despite, like, against all odds, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it would really be that enjoyable, because science has also proven that humans always view the past with nostalgia, pretty much. We always see things in the past as being a lot better than we perceive them to be when they're in the present for us. And so I just have this feeling that the past would be really disappointing to us all. And so, well, I don't know. Maybe Fitzroy knows.
That's a good point.
Past actually is like kind of like dirty and smelly and uncomfortable. Like, you know.
Right. All right. So let's plow through this. Like I said. So that's the plot. Fitzroy's going to take out Xavier in the past. It's enough to convince Storm and Wolverine to travel back to help Bishop out, even though they sense right away that by doing this, they know they're not going to be in love in the future, and that's a big sacrifice to make. Wolverine's completely resistant, but Storm's like, yeah, I'll trade up my romance for a better world. She has less issues than Wolverine does. But Wolverine's romantic life is very tragic, as we all know. So they go back in time. It's the 1950s. All these characters make no effort to have any sense of inconspicuousness.
Yeah, yeah.
They're happy just wearing their leather future apocalyptic gear, brandishing their massive futuristic weapons, and just all of them being on steroids is out of place to 1950s.
Bishop is huge. Bishop is he's huge.
Yeah, I know. He's like, yeah, he's like The Rock times three.
Yeah. Like, yeah, we've got Mardi Gras here next week, and I'm expecting to see like seven guys who look like Bishop.
Okay. Post them on the X-Men Task Facebook group. Yeah, yeah. I happen to see any bishops out there.
Pretty much dressed as Jean Grey, which is the sort of disconnect.
Right. So they're back in the 50s, and here's like a great like sidebar that the writers put in this wacky episode. They go to a 1950s beatnik cafe, which they also let kids know it's not the hippie era, it's the beatnik era. Mm-hmm. Even though it's sort of like a cool college town diner or cafe, the owner is clearly a racist, and he does not like the sight. Forget about the fact that they're wearing such bizarre clothing, and Shard has, you know, her like shaved head comb over,
and she's using this like wrist projector technology.
Yeah, in out and open. Forget about all that. The owner just notices that Wolverine and Storm's hands are touching and that they're in love, and so he makes a big racist scene in front of them.
And
that's like a great, you know, moment to show kids that, hey, like, you know, the past sucked too. You know, it's like they're not painting the past in any sort of idealistic light. Like, the future's bad, but the past has also had its problems. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the seeds of everything that's wrong with the future.
Mm.
Any thoughts, Brent?
I think it's a really great scene to get that idea across. And something the X-Men comics, of course, do, but the cartoon does so well, is using the mutant struggle as a metaphor for racism and homophobia and other forms of discrimination. I just looked it up real quick. The case of Loving versus Virginia, the landmark civil rights case in the U.S. about interracial marriage, as it was called then.
Insane to think that that was like a legal barrier to people back then.
But that's 1967. That's 8 years after this.
Yeah.
So, and that's why to this character, what he sees Logan and Aurora doing is so shocking. And but it gets across to kids that, you know, racism was a thing then and is still a thing now. And it's interesting how in the dystopian present that Wolvie and Storm have come from, Storm's like, prejudice based on skin color? That's almost quaint. And it's like, right, so...
I love Wolverine's reaction to that line where he says it's not quaint. You know, like, first of all, he's being completely true, but he was born like 1875, so he knows well like about the history and brutality of racism in America and the world. You know,
especially
based on skin color. So, like, it's just like a nice little character beat, unintentional or intentional, where you can see that like he's reminded of the pain of bigotry in that, you know, in that antiquated sense that Storm considers it to be. Like, it's almost like a wound's opened up for him again, too.
Mm. But also, we have this dystopian present, like 1995, it's a war zone, as you said earlier, the whole planet seems to be ruined, but at least racism's not there. And it's like, is that what it's going to take to get rid of racism? Like, some kind of massive cataclysm where all the people who are racist or discriminatory in some way go, oh, this shit doesn't matter anymore.
Well, I mean, I hope it doesn't take violent cataclysm to advance humankind in any way. I think the lesson of all the media that, you know, we come to enjoy, you know, a lot of it science fiction based, but any sort of like speculative fiction about the future, the lesson's always that, you know, violence is not like a solution to anything. Like, really, that people just have to stop the pettiness of whatever is dividing them now before it does lead to some sort of violent cataclysm.
But it's not that violent cataclysm made racism dissipate in like the X-Men future. It's that the racism against mutants took over so much.
Oh,
so,
That's
a, right?
Yeah.
So, like, racism is still, like, very alive in, like, the X-Men universe. It's just transformed, like...
It's United the Humans.
Right.
We've talked about how the Brotherhood of Humanity is like a multiracial group of people.
Yes. Yeah.
It's like one step forward, two steps backwards in a weird way.
Mm.
We found a new thing to be shitty to each other about.
I'm on the more positive outlook towards these things. I think in general, especially in this day and age, the negative people in the world always get the most attention.
Mm.
Whereas there's a broad sense of people, like, no matter what, even if they do like hold secret bigoted views or whatever, there's a civilizing like aspect to most people's nature where they're not going to be like open assholes about it, especially in this day and age. So and to me that is
except on the internet.
Well, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But even on the internet, I don't know. My point is, like, I tend to think that like there is like a civilizing force that is slowly picking up steam. At least I hope to think it is. Me personally, I have to think it's happening in order to be sane about this world.
No, I think in general, overarchingly, I think that is happening, and I think that was something that this cartoon was looking forward to.
Right.
Because generally speaking, in the English-speaking political world in the early 90s, various countries were moving towards more progressive politics.
Mm. Right.
Yes. At the time.
Yeah.
And then that was followed by a conservative wave, and now we're kind of in a weird area where we had a progressive wave, and some places are more progressive now, and some places are going back into conservatism.
Things are bubbling right now. It's hard to say what's going on.
Yeah. I think in general, this X-Men cartoon does have a political message, which is quite rare for children's entertainment, but the political message is just basically be nice to each other, or, you know, if we don't work together for a better future, this kind of future might happen.
The stakes are enormously high.
And
it's great to throw that in the X-Men universe because their stakes are always high, but so much of their conflict does arise from like weird, you know, racism, geopolitical issues related to racism and bigotry and oppression and all these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like that's why the show is great and holds up. It's not one of those nostalgic shows where you sit through and it's like a chore. You can only appreciate it because you liked it as a kid. It really does. I have shown it to my little nephews and they get something out of it to this day.
Mm.
And so kudos again to the X-Men.
Yeah.
And then I just want to say they get into a fight in the cafe with all these local thugs at the time. The cafe owner has two thugs named Moose and Rocco. I just have to say that out loud because I find that ridiculous.
Yeah, I watched that and I'm like, why? Does he have this much trouble with his patrons that he needs hired muscle?
Right. It seems like a really like laid back, you know, college town full of intellectuals. Why does he need Moose and Rocco in the back room ready to fight at a moment's notice? I
mean,
he's a local connected mafia guy. Who knows? Anyway, as all this fighting's going on, Professor X is running. Young Professor X, who's bald, by the way, weirdly,
and can walk.
He can walk in this era. I just like the one line he says as he's running away, because they're there to protect him, Shard, Bishop, Wolverine. He says as he's running away, he says it's all so unreal. I just like that. I thought that was a very true observation that someone in his position would make. Although, I don't know, it's hard for me to really buy him as like the audience surrogate of normalcy, because he does have an insane power of reading people's minds. So,
but he says that he doesn't like to use it.
Yeah, but still, he should know that the world's weirder than it is based on his own existence.
Mm.
He wouldn't be. So, I don't think really he'd be that thrown for a loop by like bizarre things happening. I mean, although the things happening are super bizarre because it's time travel and it's super weird looking people compared to a 1950s lad.
Yeah.
But I do like that moment. And then what else happens in this episode? And then there's another big battle. Nimrod, the borderline scary Nimrod as a cartoon character appears, and they have a big fight with him. So Nimrod, he's the white sentinel with the sort of pink like jewel encrusted chest, he just can't be stopped. Like even if you manage to blow him up, he just reforms himself, kind of like the Terminator. And there's a lot of Terminator sort of like ripoffs going on in this episode too.
Mm.
Although it's who's to say who ripped off who, really, in the grand pop culture scheme of things. So they fight Nimrod. And then, but it's too late. A bomb goes off in Professor Xavier's room, and the episode ends on Bishop like shouting "No" very dramatically, and that's the end of For One Man's Worth Part One. Mm. Any last thoughts on this episode, Sonia and Brendan?
After you, Sonia.
I mean, we've covered a lot of thoughts. Right. For me, like, this episode passed by really quickly, which I guess is a good thing. They really kept the action rolling, and I liked this as a two-parter because there was definitely enough story to go around for two parts. And I really like the device that they use to show where they, like, superimpose one scene over another to show, like, the time difference of it, like when Professor X is reading thoughts and things like that. I don't know. I guess they've used that in other episodes maybe, but in this one it was very, like, the pace of it was really good, and I think that was a device that helped the pace move along really well. So, overall... really good.
Five X's out of five X's.
Like
that we keep inventing new rating systems.
Brendan, how about you?
I really like this one. Possibly because I've seen it before. When I was watching it this morning, I was just kind of like, okay, the first half of this is kind of exposition. Yeah, let's go. I want to go back to 1959. Come on, let's go. But... It was good. It was getting me interested. It was engaging me, and I especially love how they establish the relationship between Wolverine and Storm really, really well and really quickly, just with a few lines of dialogue, a few looks, and of course the shots of the rings.
And it's a very intimate relationship.
Yeah, and. Not only that, it's also a very respectful relationship. Like, even when Storm is kind of saying to Wolverine, no, put your claws away, he's like, oh, okay, I will.
Yeah, it's really wonderful.
And also when that moment you mentioned earlier where Wolverine's like, no, I don't want to change the timeline. It's terrible here, but I've got Storm. And she's like, well, no, we have to do the right thing. And he's kind of like, okay, for you. And it's especially nice because, as you said earlier, Wolverine has this tragic love life in the cartoons and in the comics even more so. It is nice to give him this sort of respite. But also, it would have been really easy to focus the story on Logan to the detriment of Storm, but they are treated equally by the plot. You get one, you get the other. And I think that's a wonderful way to handle it. And you've got Bishop and Shard as well. And as you say, Shard hasn't really been in it before. She's not referred to by name, but they get strong moments too.
Yes.
It's just amazing how much they manage to cram into this 22 minutes.
It's the greatest tribute to the show. They cram in so much subtlety into 22 minutes in so many different episodes where you're just surprised where they can convey complex relationships or complex ideas in just flashes. And in a way, they do it, even though it's really quick, in some ways they do it superior to the movies. Just the ideas they can get across really quickly that you can understand and digest without belaboring it and keeping the action exciting and fun and
the storyline.
It's almost
like a shorthand language that they have.
Yeah.
But, like, I also like that the way the relationship between Wolverine and Storm is portrayed, it's almost like showing Wolverine in a happy relationship could really be to the detriment of his overall character. Easily, I think. But like you said, because of the way they treat that relationship, he doesn't lose his personality in it. He's still got all the Wolverine traits that you want to see. And Storm is just like a really nice addition to his life in some ways, and he to hers, you know? Like, they create, like, a balance within the relationship.
A balance existing in a post-apocalypse, like, scenario. So that is the trade-off. He can't, like, really have happiness still. But he's made it work somehow in a world where they're probably eating cockroaches
for
dinner.
Work-life balance in a post-apocalyptic world. That's what it is.
You need superhuman abilities to make that happen. I think this episode was a classic, and part two, I think it's of a piece. Very well done. I agree with everything you guys said. A lot going on. Just everything we're just talking about makes me think it's one of the most beautifully written episodes we've seen yet. And really speaks highly for what I think we have in store for season four. Seasons one through three are tattooed in my brain. But seasons four and five are definitely a little bit more faded, so I'm more excited to see what happens, just because I don't remember it as well. And I said, this two-parter, I haven't seen that often, so for me it was a real treat as someone who's watched a show more reasonably than any young adult should, now almost middle-aged adult. I hate to say it, it was just really nice and pleasant to experience.
Pleasant to experience the post-war apocalypse of
and Brandon,
2055.
I just want to say one last point to what you're talking about, how Storm, Rogue, and Gambit were your favorite characters. Obviously I dearly loved those characters too as a kid, and to me that's one of the biggest secret gripes I have with the movies, is how Storm, Rogue, and Gambit were not done well. You just knew what their potential was and how great they were, or how great they could be, and they were just it was a swing and a miss on all three, in my opinion at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange for me in that I really love what Anna Paquin does with the character.
Right.
I just don't feel she was given enough.
Right. It's not the same. I mean, the Anna Paquin character's fine for what she is, and in the confines of those movies, it makes sense. But to me, it's I still want to see green leotard Rogue, sassy 22-year-old Rogue that can fly around like Superman,
That's the main thing. I don't want to see her as a teenager. I want to see Rogue with agency.
Yeah, and that humor and stuff. So I have this glimmer of a hope that when Disney gets X-Men back, that they're going to be able to right that wrong somehow. I don't know. Maybe they're going to make the same mistakes, but I would like to see a more bodacious Rogue and Storm, especially going forward in the future.
Yeah. You know what? I think probably like the two of you and everyone listening, what I'm really waiting for is X-Men, the animated series, the movie.
Oh my God. Yeah.
That'd be amazing.
Yeah. That would be amazing.
That would be incredible. I don't think that's ever going to happen. They're probably going to do a new. They're definitely going to do a new animated series. I don't think they're going to pay tribute to this one in any way. I think it's going to be totally new and different with new actors, and that's fine. And it has to be updated, I'm sure, for a new young generation. But you're right. It would be nice. I think all the voice actors are still alive. Maybe the guy who did Professor X passed, actually. I think he's the one who did pass. And the man who played Apocalypse, he's a famous actor from the 60s. He passed as well.
Yeah, John Holocaust, yeah.
Yeah, but still, that would be one of those things that I think it would generate enormous amounts of internet excitement if they just said, we're going to do an X-Men animated series movie.
I hope that they would keep the tone the same, though, because it's a Disney production. And not that they don't have heavier themes sometimes, but mostly Disney really sticks with uplifting more than anything else. And post-apocalyptic racism isn't so uplifting, but it is an important theme that if there's a way to get kids to notice or think about it is really positive overall for society. But I wouldn't leave it to Disney to be the ones to introduce something like that, like this show did.
Difficult to say. I mean, Disney's track record on these things is a little mixed. I mean, on the one hand, they can do marvelous stuff like Black Panther, which has tons of heavy messages on racism and the history of racism. So they're I think they're entering those waters. Some might say a little bit reluctantly, just because it's taken them so long to go there. But I think when they get the X-Men back, I think they're going to be forced to thematically go to those places. And we'll see. So, all right, let's leave it right there, because we got to get to part two. But Brendan, I want you to again plug everything you have to plug, please.
Okay, fantastic. You can find our podcasts at flightthroughentirety.com. That's for our Doctor Who podcast, and bondfinger.com apart for our James Bond podcast. On Twitter, we are at FTE Podcast and at Bondfingercast. And you can also search for the names of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts and Facebook and find us there. Do come along. We don't bite unless asked.
Said with stunning pronunciation. follow us on, well, follow me on Twitter at Willie Simpson. Sonia is gave up Twitter a long time ago, so I apologize to our fans because she'd probably generate more interest there than I can. But join the X-Men Task podcast Facebook group. That's where all the real action is. It's how we connected with the likes of Brendan and other fans. And it's just, Brendan, again, thank you so much for appearing this week. It's awesome. It's been a long time in the works here, but I think this is really going to be one of our better episodes. So I just want to thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
No worries. Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, and we look forward to having you again for next week to continue with One Man's Worth.
Yes, I think we might time travel there, though, and take the shorter route.
Perhaps, yeah. So, wink, wink. I already, like, let the cat out of the bag a little bit. And also rate us 5 stars on iTunes. I don't even know if that even matters, but just do it anyway.
They say it does.
Yeah, they say it seems to matter.
Whoever they is.
I honestly don't even care anymore. I'm happy with the audience size we've achieved, and I think like the more attention you get is actually, you might be asking for trouble in a lot of ways. Especially if you like try to intend to keep living a normal life. You know, I don't need all our fans are wonderful. We've not like received any negativity. Right? Yeah. So it's like I'm almost happy with the secret club we got going here. Brendan. Yeah.
I have a funny story about meeting a fan, but I'll save it for the beginning of next week's episode. So do come back for that, dear listeners.
All right. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.